This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. To begin the new year, Happy New Year's, we're going to get cooking here on the Afternoon Magazine. On the program, we'll take a look at how we can painlessly shake up our culinary repertoire. Our guest is food writer Andrew Schloss. He is the author, with Ken Bookman, of 2,500 recipes every day to extraordinary. In this book, you'll find 50 chapters. Each chapter contains 50 recipes. The book is divided into four parts. The first part, called The Toolbox, is about basic techniques and preparations. The second part is about basics like seasonings and sauces. The third and fourth parts of the book are everyday cooking and cooking for special occasions. There's something here for everyone, as they say. One chapter is devoted to kid food, although there are plenty of recipes elsewhere in the book that kids will love, including a chapter on pizza. There are a couple of chapters on fish and shellfish. There are several chapters on vegetables and fruit, divided by season. And for special occasions, here you'll find recipes for entertaining and romance, as well as low-calorie and health food recipes. Listeners, I invite you to join our discussion this afternoon. You can join the conversation with your questions and comments. Maybe you have a recipe or a tip or a story you'd like to share with us about food. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest, Andrew Schloss. He is the author of 10 cookbooks and past president of the International Association of Culinary Professionals. The book, 2,500 Recipes Every Day to Extraordinary, is published by Robert Rose. Again, the phone number is 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Andrew, welcome. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, Celeste.
How are you?
I am fine. I'm recovering from a cold, but
yeah.
I'm okay. So I might sound a little nasal.
I'm right there on the same page with you.
Right.
It was a rough cold, but now I'm feeling a whole lot better.
That's good. Me too.
Yeah. Now, this book had its origins back almost 20 years ago now. What led you and Ken Bookman to put that first book of 2,500 recipes together?
Well, it's a funny story. Ken was my editor at the Philadelphia Inquirer. And one day someone came up to him in the parking lot and said, "I've got a headline for an article, and it is 50 Ways to Love Your Liver." And so I was writing for him, and he called me and he said, "I've got this great headline, but I need an article to go under it, and it needs 50 liver recipes. Can you write 50 liver recipes?" And I said, "Sure." Mm. And so I hung up. 20 minutes later, I called him back, and I said, "I've got 15 of them now." And the problem was, in a newspaper, because this started as a newspaper article, is the window for copy is pretty small.
Yeah.
And because of that, we needed to, in order to get 50 recipes in there, we needed to create a new recipe format. And so we shrunk everything down, and the recipes had to be really, really short and concise, which made our language pretty precise. What happened was that article was a big hit. I wrote the copy, the lead to the article was that I wrote new liver lyrics for 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover.
Yeah.
And there was a disc jockey in Philadelphia who sang the liver lyrics over the radio. So it got to be very popular. And we started doing a bunch of these 50 Ways articles because we figured if people loved an article on liver, they might like it even more if it was about pizza or chicken
yeah.
breast or whatever.
Chocolate
and
cake
of those articles, once they came out, once we got about 15 of them, we knew that it could be a book.
Wow. 50 chapters, 50 recipes in each one.
That's how you get to 2,500.
Yeah.
It's a lot of recipes.
How did you go about deciding what to include and what to leave out?
It's interesting. When you're making a book of this volume, Having it be done in a lot of chapters is helpful. So let's take, harvest vegetables, for instance. If we want 50 recipes for harvest vegetables, we know we're going to do broccoli, we're going to do squashes, we're going to do onions, we're going to do Brussels sprouts, we're going to do cabbages. So there are probably 15 to 20 vegetables that you know you're going to have to do in those 50 recipes, which only leaves you about 2 recipes per vegetable. And once you've got that going, you know that for the cabbage ones, you're going to do a braised one and a sautéed one, for instance. And then once you figure that out, you know what are the different cuisines that use cabbage. So we might do an Eastern European one, or we might do an Asian one. Mm-hmm. So there, it actually, when you start breaking it down in that way, it becomes somewhat limited in the amount of choices that you can have.
Yeah. Now, I can see how, that would be, before you turn around, you've got 50 recipes for harvest vegetables. But what about, let's go back to liver. How did you riff on liver for 50 recipes?
Well, liver was easy because you have chicken livers, mm-hmm. calf's liver, lamb liver, pork liver, pâtés, sautéed mm-hmm. liver, mousses. You can do liver fillings on things. You can do cold liver appetizer type things. There can be entrees. So that, again, when you look at any food, and this is the amazing thing about working with food, is when you look at any food, it telescopes out. That is, one of the things that's nice about having borders is that it makes you concentrate, and you can start to see the depth within that border.
Hmm. When did you begin cooking, and what led you to the kitchen?
I started cooking as a kid. What led me to the kitchen was science, magic and science. My mother was not a cook. My mother made dinner. She didn't cook. We ate well, but she never was into it. And my grandmother cooked, my father's mother made custard, and it was one of the things I like, baked custard. And one day I was at her house, and she was making the custard, and I was watching, and she took milk and sugar and eggs, put them in a bowl, mixed them up. It was this liquid thing. She stuck it in the oven, and it became solid. That was completely cool to me. And so I started cooking, and I took a copy of Joy of Cooking and started working with it. And then I think the first thing I made out of Joy of Cooking was white sauce. And it was the same thing. I took milk and flour and butter, and it became something completely different than its ingredients. So I think it's that fascination of how food works, of how heat transforms ingredients, that made me want to cook.
Yeah. It's interesting that you mentioned grandmothers and white sauce, because that was one of the first things that I learned to make at the side of my grandmother. And it was like pretty miraculous. Here you have some things that when they're apart, they don't really rock, but put them together and add a little heat and it tastes pretty good.
Yeah, it's amazing. And I'm still fascinated by it. Yeah. Right now I'm writing a food science encyclopedia. And I'm still learning stuff.
Wow. Some weeks back, we were talking about cooking here on this program, and a listener called in and said, I wish my skills in the kitchen were better. In terms of the basics, maybe you would talk with us about what a beginning cook will find useful in 2,500 recipes.
I think the main thrust of 2,500 recipes is that it's for people who cook already, that they would have, it's made so that it assumes you have a chicken breast in your hand and you want to know, what do I do with this tonight? And maybe you have 5 recipes for chicken breast. And here you're going to have 50 that are right in front of you. Hopefully 4 of them you've never thought of before and you've got the ingredients on hand. So it's meant to be an everyday kind of cookbook. But even for people who've never cooked before, you mentioned in the structure of the book that there are these toolbox sections in the front. The toolboxes are meant to be explanations of techniques that a novice cook might not know. So within a recipe, I would tell people to just sauté something because I want to be concise. But in the front of the book, in the toolbox, I will explain precisely what I mean when I say sauté. When you cook something in oil, it'll explain the difference between deep frying, sautéing, and pan frying, and how much time you would spend for each one, how much oil you would use, what temperature you would use, what kind of ingredients would be better for each of those kind of techniques. So I assume that the person who is using that doesn't know anything. And that also bridges to my love of the science of cooking, because one of the things about science is it's very basic, and it really it takes cooking down to its roots, and that's what I try and do in the front of the book.
Yeah. Do you have formal training? Or
yes.
Yeah. Okay. Tell us about that a little bit.
I went to school in Europe, in Denmark, and I started cooking there in a kitchen, ended up running the kitchen for the school by the time I left the school, and then came back to the United States, worked in restaurants, and then I went to culinary school in Philadelphia, opened a restaurant, had a restaurant for about 8 years, and then during that 8 years I got married, I had children, never saw my children, and I ended up wanting to teach, and so because teaching was one of the things I liked in being a chef, I liked training my staff, I liked doing new things, and so I started teaching and ended up being the director of the main culinary school in Philadelphia for about 10 years.
Wow. So now you're a chef, you're a food writer, you're a teacher. What's the learning curve in the kitchen?
The learning curve. I learn stuff every single day. I think one of the interesting things about cooking for people is, well, I think there's an interesting thing in cooking to me, that, and it's an evolution. A lot of what you read about cooking now is that people are not cooking it anymore, and that there's an epidemic of illiteracy in cooking, which I don't really find. I still think that most people cook most of the food that they eat, or they eat. Most people are eating at home, but the thing that has changed is the ability to get food has changed from a function of cooking it yourself to having lots of other options. Where at one time, I think cooking was a survival skill. Now, there are so many ways of getting dinner on the table that cooking is just one of them. And if you, the only reason to cook now is because you're interested in it and because it's fun to you and because you want to do it. Because there's lots of other ways of eating. So I think where at one time you talked about a learning curve because cooking was sort of an essential skill that people who ran a home had to have,
mm-hmm.
Now I think the learning curve is different because it has to do with interest. It has to do with people being really wanting to do it. And so I think that way what happens is that you learn to cook by doing it, and it happens project by project, just as we talked about it. You know, we started with white sauce, and then you move on from there. So there, I think it's a natural progression that happens. I don't think you have to go to culinary school to be a good cook.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I think if you enjoy cooking, it's because it's an outlet for creativity in terms of how things taste, of course, but also how they look and how they come together in a menu. You said things have changed. Certainly they have. Convenience foods have had a mixed reputation, but, you know, when I started to look at your book, one of the things that you talk about is power flavors and powering up what we cook, and oils, herbs, sun-dried tomatoes, olives, they're very convenient and very tasty. Are there other items you'd describe as convenience foods that you think are very good or maybe better than a home cook could make?
I think there are a lot of good convenience foods out there now. When I wrote the first edition of this book 20 years ago, I assumed that if you wanted pesto, you had to make it yourself. I didn't assume that you could go to a supermarket and get it. And now I assume that most people who are going to use pesto, unless it's the middle of the summer and they're just putting the pesto right on pasta so the freshness is vital to it, I assume most people are going to buy a refrigerated or a jarred pesto to add to to use as a seasoning in a sauce or in a stew or something like that. So those kind of ingredients that are available now that prepared Thai sauces, prepared bruschetta and those kind of things, I I assume that people are going to use. I think a lot of the pre-cut produce, I assume that a lot of people are going to use. And I'm fine with that. I think it's great. Anything that that helps you get good food in your stomach is good by me.
Yeah. What would you recommend we do for ourselves?
Which kind of thing should you not use a convenience ingredient for? That's an interesting question. I think if it's in the middle of the summer and you've got a lot of great ingredients, you're going to get better flavor by doing something fresh. The thing with packaged food is all the packaged food is cooked food. And I do work with manufacturers all the time, and I don't work with any manufacturers who say they want to make bad food. They all want to make a good product. But what they're doing is they're making a product that has to last on the shelf for some time. So if you're doing something where you can make it fresh, you're going to get a more alive flavor than a manufacturer could possibly get. So I would say if you've got great fresh ingredients in front of you, you're going to get much better results by doing it yourself than any packaged food, regardless of how good it is, simply because it's fresher. If you find that your skills aren't great, then a manufacturer might do better for you. Like, for instance, I think nobody other than a seasoned amateur baker, other than a professional baker, would make puff pastry at home. Because frozen puff pastry is such a good product and so available to you. So that's a product that I would say for most people you would never make it yourself, because the packaged product is probably better than what you can make. Even though there are tons of prepared soups, there's nothing better than freshly homemade soup. So, and in the middle of this time of year, that's a great thing to make from scratch, and it makes you feel good to do it.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that we've been doing at our house lately is making our own salad dressings.
Oh, yeah.
And that is, the stuff that comes in a bottle is okay, and it's so convenient. On the other hand, it is just, speaking of magic and science.
Yeah, and it's so simple.
Yeah.
It's really simple. I always have just a bottle of salad dressing that I keep going in the refrigerator. And you can do all different kinds of salad dressings. One of the chapters in the book is about how to clean out the refrigerator. And so if a half a yogurt is a great base for a salad dressing, they're all a half a lemon. All those little spits and spots of things that are in your refrigerator are great things to add to a salad dressing and make it really easy and use up your leftovers really well as well. There are also, I think, in this book, I created a couple of salad dressings. One of the things I've started doing is pureeing canned vegetables and fruit and using that puree of canned vegetables or fruit as a replacement for the oil in a salad dressing.
Oh.
So you can make like a creamy salad dressing using canned beans, and all you need is a little bit of oil for flavor, and then add vinegar and garlic to it, and it makes this wonderful creamy salad dressing. Or you can do what are some good ones that we did? There's a blueberry salad dressing that's high in antioxidants because it's blueberries, but it also gets that kind of sweet sour thing from using a fruit. There's a canned pea salad dressing that looks sort of like a green goddess dressing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and those cut the fat way back. Those dressings, when I did the nutritionals on them, went from 120 calories per serving, which is typical for salad dressing, to 20 calories per serving.
Yeah. Guacamole vinaigrette. That sounds like a good one, too.
That's another.
Mm-hmm. You get the fatty feel from the avocado. And then
That's a monounsaturated fat, which is good for you.
Yeah, so that's simply avocado, garlic, white wine vinegar, a little pinch of cayenne pepper, and salt and freshly ground black pepper.
That's it. And the vinegar will help it keep its color, which is one of the problems with avocados generally.
Yeah, very interesting. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Andrew Schloss. He is the author most recently with Ken Bookman of 2,500 Recipes Every Day to extraordinary. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Maybe you have a recipe, a tip, or a story about food you'd like to share with us. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. The book, 2,500 Recipes Every Day to Extraordinary, is published by Robert Rose. Well, maybe you would share with us some ideas for powering up a dish with those power flavors that you like.
Why don't we talk about romantic, because that's
good
with power flavors, and we're getting, you have to start thinking about Valentine's Day, because it's past New Year's already.
Yeah.
To me, what makes a food a romantic or a seductive food is that when you put it in your mouth, it makes you lose consciousness for a second. And there are all kinds of things you can do for those kind of foods. One of my favorite things is, I'm trying to think of like a good one. Cajun oysters are a good one. These are just oysters that are sautéed in their own liquor. You don't need any fat with them, because you want to add cream, so you don't want to add any other fat. And then you take the oysters out, you add cream to the pan, and a lot of Tabasco sauce. And the acid in the Tabasco sauce makes the cream instantly coagulate into a sauce. And the hotness of the Tabasco with the sort of richness of the cream balance one another perfectly. And it's one of the things I love about that dish is it's three ingredients. It's oysters, cream, and Tabasco, and it has this incredibly powerful, complex flavor from those three ingredients coming together. That's a really good one. So hot sauces, and there's a lot of different hot sauces that you can use to power up flavors in that way. I'm trying to think of other ones. Anchovies are an interesting one in that anchovies are a really strong flavor, and when you're working with something like an anchovy or blue cheese is another ingredient that's like this that's very, very strong, a little bit of it goes an incredibly long way. You would never want to take a whole anchovy and start chomping on it, but if you put a little bit of it into a stew, even a chicken stew, or into a chicken, mix it with some garlic and some olive oil, and I'll usually use a little bit of like V8 juice or something vegetably with it as well, and rub that under the skin of a chicken when you roast it. You won't even taste the anchovy as anchovy. It just adds a depth of flavor. It has a kind of fermented flavor that gives a base to the other flavors that you're adding with it. So using things that might almost feel like too strong to eat as an ingredient themselves, and think of them as how they would harmonize with other ingredients, how they would form like an anchovy forms like a base note to that kind of sweet, tangy quality in the vegetable juice.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking at, from Romantic Recipes, that chapter, I'm looking at something with a lot of wonderful flavors in it. And it's something that if you do enough Asian cooking, these are things that you'll run across over and over again. And I think that this is getting back to the idea of the learning curve. After you read enough things, I think, and you get into the kitchen and you turn some things out, eventually you find yourself being more intuitive about things. But spicy shiitake mushrooms, lots of wonderful flavors here. Garlic, hoisin sauce, dark sesame oil, ginger root, dry sherry, hot pepper flakes, the mushrooms, of course. And then here's something, though, that you do that's a little different. A little bit of a lemon wedge on the side.
Mm-hmm.
What led you to that decision?
Some of it is the acid, but also it's a fruit, and it's sweetness that it's adding. Lemon and citrus fruits are an interesting thing because they're both acid and they're sweet. So sugars can bring other flavors out. So what I think the lemon is doing in that is it's working with the sherry, it's working with the hoisin sauce, and it's sort of rounding out that flavor system. Actually, now that I'm thinking about it, I would actually, if I was going to redo this recipe, here I go working it again, I would probably take some lemon zest and throw that in there. Because lemon zest is amazing with mushrooms. It brings the sort of woody flavor in the mushrooms out.
It's also very pretty.
Yeah.
It's also very pretty. One of the things that I, speaking of lemon, and something that I really like very much, and I think you do have a number of recipes about for mussels in this book.
Mm-hmm.
Forgive me for trying to keep up here, but I mean, there's a lot. There's 2,500 recipes
That's
in
right.
here. But mussels with olive oil, white wine, tomatoes, basil, and lemon zest.
Mm-hmm.
Very good.
Mussels, I really like mussels. Mussels are one of those things that have a very pungent flavor, and they're a power flavor in and of themselves. And they also produce their own sauce, which is great, as they cook. One of my favorite things is a soup where you just take canned tomatoes. And I like working with canned tomatoes because they're just cooked tomatoes so that there's not really a compromise in them. Actually, when we're talking about that difference between fresh and processed food, a canned tomato is one of the things that, out of season, you're probably getting a better product out of the can than you would from starting with fresh. So just canned tomatoes. There's some Italian herbs in it, like oregano and basil and garlic. Put that in a saucepan and just throw the mussels into it and let the mussels open up in the tomatoes, and their liquid becomes the liquid for the sauce. For the soup. So it's a soup that literally takes 7 minutes to cook, and it's completely fresh tasting. It's wonderful.
Yeah, it's delicious. And also mussels, then you could put that over pasta.
Yeah, you could.
Yeah, or, you know, have some good bread and dunk that in there.
That's it. I'm getting hungry.
What's for dinner at your house tonight?
What's for dinner? Well, you know what? It's 2 days after New Year's.
Yeah.
We just had a big party, so I think scrambled eggs or something like that.
Something light.
Yes.
Yeah. That sounds good, though.
Yeah. Scrambled eggs are one of my favorite dinners.
Yeah. Now, what else would you have for dinner of scrambled eggs?
With scrambled eggs?
Yeah.
Well, I'd make perfect scrambled eggs.
Yeah.
So that is one thing. I would probably do a good bread, some cheese, a salad.
Mm-hmm.
I think, and then I would probably do some sort of fruit for dessert. Maybe like a baked apple or something like that.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Mm-hmm.
Or a good fruit juice for your starter.
That's true. Could do that. Or roasted pears would be good with that.
Oh, yeah, that sounds good. Mm-hmm. I'm so ready.
Right.
One of the chapters, speaking of things that go together quickly, you know, the dinner tonight thing, sometimes it's just, it's so daily. You would have 50 recipes for frying pan cuisine, and those are dishes that are meant to come together in 20 minutes.
Right.
Give us an idea of what you like to do. Scrambled eggs go into the skillet, but what else would you like to share with us in terms of frying pan cuisine?
Frying pan, which is just another way of saying sautéed things, it's a really fast way of cooking. One of the things I really like about working with a skillet is that the cooking something in a little bit of oil adds a lot of flavor, so that the technique itself has a flavor system to it and adds some flavor. When we talk about power flavors, we frequently think in terms of ingredient, but often it's the technique you use, too, that is going to add flavors to it. So I'm just looking through that chapter now. One of the things about skillets is that they're really versatile. So you can saute in oil, or I'm just looking at this poached chicken breast with warm tomato vinaigrette, which is one of these salad dressings that uses a crushed tomato in place of oil. This Thai turkey salad is really good, where you take ground turkey and brown it in some vegetable oil with some onion, and then you use Thai flavors in there, which is a combination of sugar, coriander, garlic, some hot pepper flakes, some black pepper, and then that gets tossed with roasted peanuts and Thai fish sauce and some lime juice and some sesame oil, and it's this very pungent, exotic salad that I think probably takes 8 minutes to cook up. what are some other things? Sauteed chicken breast is a really good thing. In fact, one of the things about boneless, skinless chicken breasts is they dry out so quickly. Yeah. And they're actually, even though people cook them all the time, I think they're actually one of the most difficult things to cook well because they're so lean and so delicate that they tend to get ruined really easily. But sauteing is something that is really good for chicken. And what I would do whenever I'm sauteing a boneless breast is pound it a bit so that it gets to be an even thickness, because one of the things that causes chicken to overcook is that the pointed end of the breast is so much thinner than the wider end. So pounding it out to even out that thickness is going to make it cook much more evenly and give you a better result. So there are a bunch of boneless chicken breast recipes in this skillet cuisine chapter. There's marinated chicken paillards, which are really thinly pounded chicken breast that's marinated in some salad dressing and sautéed. A sage and rosemary chicken that is just breaded and fried. Deviled chicken breasts. Chicken with lime avocado relish. This is just a sautéed chicken breast, and just take chopped up avocado, mix it with some parsley, some lime, some garlic, some tomatoes, sort of almost like a guacamole relish on the surface of them.
Yeah.
This is an interesting chapter. It's good.
It is a good chapter. And
yeah.
One of the things that I'm going to try soon is the poached chicken breast with warm tomato vinaigrette, because here we have a canned tomato product in the recipe. And yet, you know, I when I look down this recipe, I see lots of really wonderful flavors coming together. Of course, you've got your boneless, skinless chicken breast, chicken cooked in some chicken broth, garlic, and then you make kind of a glaze with the canned tomatoes or crushed tomatoes and the olive oil and some red wine vinegar, and then you just put some beautiful parsley on the top. And,
And the other thing that's sort of nice in this recipe is how you're using the oil. One of the things about power flavors is using ingredients so that they deliver the most flavor to the palate. When you sauté in olive oil, a lot of the volatile aromas in the oil go away because of the high heat of sautéing. In this one, we're poaching the chicken breast, which is a really low-fat way of cooking it, and then adding a little bit of oil to the tomatoes in a raw way so that you're getting all of the flavor of that extra virgin olive oil in the sauce, and it's hitting the palate first. So that's another way of having a lot of another way of getting powerful flavor is by where you place the flavor on the plate and in the recipe.
Very interesting. And that's something else that would be good at this time of the year when you just feel like you've just come through this long holiday period.
Yeah.
Where you're just like, I've had it. It was wonderful while it was going on, but now it's time to kind of relax and have something that tastes very good, but it's a little lighter.
Yeah.
And is also doesn't demand much time in the kitchen because you've got other things you want to be doing. Speaking of this recipe, though, uses chicken broth to poach the chicken breasts. Another recipe that I think would be people would be interested in, our listeners, is many of us might have the slow cooker out now because it's really cold here. It's 13 degrees now.
Wow.
That's kind of a nice thing to have, something, you know, cooking all day and it's really cold. But you can make chicken broth in your slow cooker.
Right.
And you have recipes for slow-cooked chicken broth and slow-cooked beef broth. And this chapter, I believe, begins on page 69. So how did you come up with – and I haven't done a lot of cooking with the slow cooker, but how did you approach chicken broth in a slow cooker?
Well, one of the things about a slow cooker is slow cookers they actually go back to almost pre-kitchen cooking, where before there were mechanized kitchens, the way people cooked is that they either roasted over an open fire, or they had a fire where they had to sit something that cooked for a long period of time all the way in the back of the coals, and it cooked very slowly. And that's actually what a slow cooker is doing. It's a ceramic pot that's sitting in an insert that has a very low heating element in it, and it's like sitting something on the back of the stove and just letting it go. And that's what broths are. That's how you make broth. So it was actually, there was no conversion at all to make broth in a slow cooker. It was a natural thing to do with it because that's what that machine does.
Mm-hmm.
The main difference in working with slow cookers is that they produce an incredible amount of liquid. It is both their great advantage and their bane. The problem that slow cooker recipes have is because they draw liquid out of the ingredients that go into them, that liquid, it's a closed system, so the liquid doesn't evaporate. And when you're cooking on a stovetop, there's a great deal of evaporation that happens out of the pot. And that makes you lose liquid, makes you lose volume, that dries things out. But it also concentrates flavors. In a slow cooker, flavors don't concentrate terribly well. So what you have to do is use a lot less liquid than you would normally. So in this slow-cooked chicken broth, which I think gives us how much? About a
16
gallon.
16 cups, yeah.
Yeah, we're only using, we're starting with that amount of water. But there, in the broth, that's not a good example. If we were doing a stew, you would see that we're starting with maybe a third of the water that you would do on a stovetop. If you were cooking a stew on a stovetop, because the amount of liquid that's going to get trapped in the slow cooker. And that way you can get really concentrated flavors in the food as well.
Yeah. Maybe you'd run down that recipe. It's 3 pounds of chicken parts and then 16 cups of water, and then what do we do from there?
And then you have a carrot, two carrots, two stalks of celery, a large onion. You chop them up pretty coarsely. In it is the herbs that you would put into a chicken broth, which is salt, a whole peppercorns, and you want to be careful in a slow cooker not to use ground spices, particularly peppers, because they grow in a slow cooker.
Okay.
Poultry seasoning, and use some sort of, don't use ground poultry seasoning, use like whole leaf poultry seasoning, and some fresh parsley, some clove, and some bay leaf, and then just stick it in there and let it go.
That sounds great, and you just put it in there 8 to 10 hours on low, you strain it, and you've got homemade chicken broth, which mm-hmm. has so many uses, and, you know, I've always thought of it as a big pain in the neck.
No, that's the thing about a slow cooker is, what's a pain in the neck on the stovetop is time,
yeah.
And a slow cooker, time is the convenience.
Yeah.
You put it in there and walk away.
Yeah.
I like to say it's the only cooking technique that benefits from neglect.
Yeah. Go read War and Peace or something.
Right.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, we'd like to hear from you this afternoon. You can join us with a question, with a comment. Our guest this afternoon is Andrew Schloss. He is the author with Ken Bookman of 2,500 Recipes Every Day to Extraordinary. My name is Celeste Quinn. You can join us this afternoon, listeners, with a telephone call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Well, there's a chapter devoted to children, although, as I mentioned in the introduction, there are lots of things in this book that kids would enjoy. But when it comes to children, you say they're naturally cautious and unnaturally conservative. What kind of advice do you have for us? These are kid-tested recipes.
Mm-hmm.
So what can we do to expand the palate of a picky young eater?
Ignore that they're a picky young eater is the best
yeah.
advice, and just give them food. I think most children actually perceive flavors more intensely than adults do. Our ability to perceive flavor diminishes as we age, and so when a kid is eating something that has garlic in it, they would perceive that garlic much more intensely than than an adult would. And it can be, you know how garlic can sort of like burn your tongue?
Mm-hmm.
For a kid, that can happen much more intensely. So I would say you want to dial back seasonings maybe a little bit if you're introducing them to a kid. But I wouldn't not give them flavors. With my children are fairly grown now, but what we did was they ate whatever we ate, and I found that it was more about the social activity of eating than it was about the food.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I started doing, I actually did it once because I just was flipping out and couldn't get dinner together, and I was cooking in the kitchen, and I just called the kids in the kitchen, and I put them on stools and sat them in front of the stove and handed them things off the stove. Just as it was cooking, mm-hmm. I handed it to them. They ate more that night than ever. And so I just started doing that, like once a month. I would just bring them into the kitchen and feed them off the stove. And they loved that. That was good.
Yeah.
We did. And they would eat more. And they would eat unusual things that way. We also did what we called chip night, which was instead of doing a main course, I did a bunch of different whole grain chips and whole grain potato. We did potato chips and whole grain corn chips and wheat chips and those kind of things, and then all kinds of vegetable dips. And they ate more vegetables that way than they ever ate being piled on a dinner plate.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of it is thinking about what it's sort of it's making it fun.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's thinking about what the food. Don't be. I think a lot of times adults also are sort of prejudiced about what's good food and what's bad food.
Mm-hmm.
Where if you think about it, salsa is vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
And so why not have salsa and a corn chip instead of stewed tomatoes and corn?
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, it's the same thing. So it, I think there's that kind of element to it. And the other thing that I think works with kids that also works with adults is, you know, this whole small plate phenomenon in restaurants,
mm-hmm.
where people eat much more adventurous foods in small amounts.
Mm-hmm.
I think kids are the same way. I think if you give them like a little bit of something, like a little taste of something, and make it look cool, they'll tend to eat it. Oh, and I know the other thing. I never told my children what was in anything, because they would come into the kitchen. They'd say, "Well, what are we having for dinner?" And I also never told them what was for dinner. They would say, "What are we having for dinner?" I would start to say things, and they would, and I would say, "We're having chicken," and they'd say, "What else?" And I'd say, "And we're having potatoes," and they'd say, "What else?" I said, "I'm not telling you anything more because you're just waiting for me to say spinach so you can say ooh."
Yeah, and then the kid gets to go away and stew for an hour before
right.
dinner, and say, "Yuck! I'm not going to like that."
Right. I said, "It's a mystery. We're having mystery."
There's a wonderful film, a German film called Mostly Martha. I don't
yes.
know if you've seen it. And in that situation, there's a little girl whose heart is broken. Her mother has died. And it's an issue to get her to eat. And eventually they do, thanks to a wonderful Italian chef. And he makes it so much fun. He brings magic to it. And they
mm-hmm.
they have a meal on the floor in the living room. And she polishes everything off.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And then they, in the middle of dinner, I think they play pickup sticks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one good way of getting kids to eat is get rid of utensils.
Hmm.
Eat with your hands.
Yeah,
finger food.
Yeah,
night.
Yeah.
That's a good way. Yeah, it's sort of breaking down. It's making it interesting. It's the same reason people like to go to restaurants. Adults like to go to restaurants. It's fun. There's an entertainment aspect to it, which is a lot of what enjoying food is about. It's not, and I guess that's the other thing with children is we think so much about getting children to eat almost as a duty, and forget about it as having fun eating.
Yeah,
which is the reason people want to eat is
yeah.
because it's enjoyable.
Yeah,
not because it's a duty.
Tell us about xylophone milk.
Oh, xylophone milk! I love that. that was something I developed with my children where. We did, and it was a way of having them have chocolate milk with not a lot of chocolate in it. You take chocolate syrup and you paint lines on the inside of a glass and then fill it up with cold milk. And then as the kid drinks the milk, they can tap it with a pencil or a spoon or something, and it changes tone as the milk goes down.
Yeah. Science and magic.
Yep.
There they are. Well, to close out here, maybe you would, maybe you're thinking about, you mentioned Valentine's Day a little earlier. Maybe you would inspire us to begin thinking about a special dessert for Valentine's Day.
Mm.
What would you, what, maybe you're already thinking
well,
about
it. It has to be chocolate.
Yeah, okay.
What I would do, making chocolate truffles is really easy, and
yeah.
I'm not sure. There are a bunch of, I think it's in the gifts from the kitchen, there's a bunch of different chocolates. Actually, making chocolates is sort of an easy thing to do, where you can just, like, crush up nuts and crush up pretzels and roll them in melted chocolate and then put them on a sheet tray, and they'll like, sort of set up as little porcupine-y things. my favorite chocolate dessert, I call triple chocolate bypass, I think.
Oh,
which,
yeah.
Which is just chocolate and cream and eggs cooked together in a pan in the oven just until the edge sets and the middle still looks like a swamp. And then you take it out and there's so much richness in it that it just sort of sets up. And it's this sort of in-between fudge, chocolate cake, chocolate mousse. It's just incredible, and it has this amazing mouthfeel. It's sort of silky, velvety inside. That's one of my favorite yeah. chocolate desserts, and really easy. It takes 5 minutes to mix it up.
Yeah, okay. And then on the 15th of February, it's to the chapter low-calorie recipes
that's
and health
it.
Food.
Oh, well, yeah.
Those
you
two
have
chapters.
To, I mean, Valentine's Day is about over the top.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's all about balance.
Mm-hmm. Right? Absolutely.
Okay. Well, there we'll leave it. Andrew, thank you so much for talking with me this afternoon. It was great fun.
It was good talking to you, too.
Andrew Schloss has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Together with Ken Bookman, he's the author of 2,500 Recipes Every Day to Extraordinary. The book is published by Robert Rose.